are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
War, what is it good for? And the answer is, well, so we get movies like Dunkirk.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Nice IMAX screenings, if only we had gone to an actual IMAX to watch this.
Thanks for dying, all you British.
Yeah.
So Mr. Nolan, decades later, could make this movie.
Well, if you'd have turned up in 1939 when you were supposed to, rather than turning up in 41, like the constant laggards you are. I mean, I suppose it's a little bit better than, you know, oh, World War One began in 1917. No, it really didn't, asshole. Thanks for the tanks.
We saved your asses.
That was the Russians.
Rather, the Germans' absolutely incredibly incompetent decision to try and invade Russia.
Yeah, that happens a lot, though.
The Russians just had to stay there and try to die more slowly for long enough, so until the Germans were like, oh, fuck, we're all dead.
You've just described Avalon Hill's Battle of Stalingrad, but we're talking about Dunkirk.
One of the greatest military failures of all time. Oh, wait, or is it?
No. Dunkirk was a massive military success because it was an impossible situation. And this, you know, Christopher Nolan dropping us right in at the climax of you know, the British Expeditionary Force's withdrawal from Europe. I mean, at this point, the British Army was screwed.
Yeah.
They were withdrawing, you know, this is the beginning of World War II. They are withdrawing. They are literally just stuck on the beach at Dunkirk, and they have no idea how to get out. And as you know, this is a defining moment in British history. This is
Americans
like
Americans are just recently starting to find out.
Yeah, because you turned up 2 years late. So, but I mean, this really was that you know you have 400,000 British troops plus a huge number of French troops stuck on the beach at Dunkirk, just getting shelled and shot, and the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe are just picking them off at will, and they're trying to take them off, you know, one destroyer at a time, which is basically an impossible task.
Yeah.
And so what happened was that Churchill went, anything with a less than 3 foot draft that can get up to, with a 3 foot draft that can get up to the beach, you send it.
Right.
Everything.
Yeah.
Pleasure boats, fishing trawlers, you know, literally guys with a little putt-putt boat.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Went across the channel under fire and just loaded up with troops and, you know, took off. And the thing is that this is Gettysburg level of significant in British culture. The whole concept of the Dunkirk spirit. And I'm explaining this because when Christopher Nolan announced that he was doing this, in a way, he was setting foot on cinematic holy ground. This is a film that, this isn't a topic that really hasn't been touched much on in British cinematic history and war films. Because it is so incredibly sensitive.
Now, I mean, was there anything, like, at the time, like, Marco and I just reviewed a movie called Their Finest that was, was fictionalized, but was based on the war propaganda organization working with the British film industry to make films to inspire the British people, and in it, they're making a movie about Dunkirk.
Yeah,
I didn't know if it was based on an actual
On YouTube,
film
I did find,
movie.
Like, yeah, a old film called Dunkirk.
Yeah, there's been a few, you've really been super cautious about this, because
right.
it's a very important moment in British history, because it really was the point where, like, if they didn't get the troops off, they weren't going to have enough troops to protect England, protect Britain against the Germans, and the Germans were just going to come across. You know, the Operation Sea Lion was just going to eviscerate the UK. So this really was the moment where Britain could have died.
And
it could have gone away.
The battle itself, this is starting at the point where they have gone, we've got to get our people out.
Well, there was the Battle of Dunkirk. This was the thing. I mean, you'd already had the war.
They're evacuating.
It's like, this opens with just a bunch of guys stood on a beach.
Yeah.
That's one of the really smart decisions of this movie, because rather than get the sort of officer or politician level view, Churchill never appears in this film. There's no cutting back to somebody in a, you know, in a office somewhere going, what are we going
to
do?
Well, he doesn't need to. He's appearing in two movies later.
Yeah, he's kind of busy right now. But what I really appreciated was that you got this sort of ground level troop, through the eyes of the troop, through the eyes of the Air Force, and through the eyes of the, let's just say the civilian artillery, or whatever, what would be the term? Basically all the people who volunteered and just took it, they just took on the responsibility of going and bringing the boys back home. That is a great way to structure this story, because it is about the people who were there, not the people making decisions somewhere else.
And we're really seeing this film through three different points of view, right, which they even number at the beginning,
correct,
of the film, to be very clear. You've got main characters of these situations, Tom Hardy as a Spitfire pilot, heroic Spitfire pilot, yeah, who's protecting the ships and the evacuation. You've got Fionn Whitehead as Tommy, who's a private in the British Army, who is just doing everything he can think of to try and get to the front of the line,
right,
to evacuate from the beach. And then you have,
the Martyr Island subplot.
And his two kids, who are one of the people coming over from London, who, yeah, are like, okay, well, we are getting our boat, and we are going to, no matter what, we're going to go over there, and we're going to rescue us some soldiers.
Not everywhere in the UK is London.
Yes, it is, Richard.
No, it's not. I know.
I'm from America, and I had school.
I know that, you know, you can get from, you know, the Adriatic to, you know, under Tower Bridge, one light evening in the DC universe. Yes, Wonder Woman, I've still not forgiven you for this one of the stupidest moments in contemporary cinema.
I thought England was just London, and then, I don't know. Like,
yeah, well, so...
I think Stonehenge is around there somewhere.
There's a bunch of big fans all over the place.
Yeah, we're just rife with them.
Yeah.
Dunkirk has a lot more historical accuracy than Wonder Woman. I'll give it that.
Or are any given review that we give about historical movies. this is like Richard's dream review. He finally doesn't have to look for a way to crowbar in something about British history. He can just go, this is about British history!
It really is. And it's one of the remarkable things about this that it catches so well is that, you know, people talk about, you know, British reticence. We don't really like talking about stuff. This is basically a dialogue-free movie most of its duration. When people communicate, it is for a reason. It is either to tell somebody something important or to communicate what they're doing at that moment, which is really, in these circumstances, it's what British people do. We clam up and we go kill that guy, run over there, you know. And one of the most beautiful things about this, and this isn't moving into any kind of spoiler territory at all, there are some moments in this where white lies are incredibly significant.
Yeah.
Because this is a film about how do you survive in these circumstances? How do you do something that you can live with? And it's not like, you know, it's not a moment of, you know, do you kill this guy or not? It's there's somebody else who, if you tell them something, it will have a consequence. What do you do at that moment?
Right.
And there's several points where not telling somebody is like, you know, a fact is the better thing to do, which is so unbelievably British. It's so, it's like, yeah, no, you know, it's the whole, no, I'm fine. You're holding your arm for me.
I'm fine, though.
Just go make yourself tea.
I'm really glad you brought up the lack of dialogue, because there are moments in this that really just plays with the images, and that's all you need to hear to get the story across. And that's why I think this is a return of form for Christopher Nolan, because I think in the past, I've been a big fan of Christopher Nolan's for many years, but somewhere maybe starting around Dark Knight, he started to get increasingly self-serious and portentous, and there was a tendency to just hammer home an idea over and over and over again, reiterate things, explain things. I get that he's trying to make intelligent films to play for a popcorn crowd, but I don't need you to explain to me how Inception works every time we go into that scene. I don't need to hear Michael Caine deliver a Dylan Thomas poem three times in one movie. I get it, Christopher Nolan. I'm not that dumb.
Actually, I can watch Michael Caine do pretty much anything.
Sure. And he makes a lovely little cameo in this, too. It's all of the Nolan company is here. But yeah, I really appreciated that. I think
Michael
this was
Caine
a time where
this?
Yeah, he was a voice.
He was a voice on the podcast.
That's who Tom Hardy was talking to.
I didn't realize that at all.
Yeah.
There's a...
If he had said Rage Against the Dying of the Light, you would have gone, that's Michael Caine.
And of course, Cillian Murphy's in this because by law, he has to be in every Christopher Nolan film.
And Tom Hardy.
Playing a soldier.
So he has to be in the movie.
Huh?
He's British, so he has to be in the movie.
You just got to be in every Christopher Nolan film. I can't remember the first one he was in, but he's been in like almost every single one.
But that's one of his great strengths. He does have a stock company, and I can see why he found a place to put Michael Caine. I think Michael Caine is his John Ratzenberger or his like Jack Nance. He's like, I've got to put this guy in my movie. He's my good luck charm. And, you know, it's nice that he was there because you obviously wouldn't have believed him as a soldier.
So, I mean, I think the main thing you take away from this movie is this is not like... It's weird to say, it's not really character-driven, but it really does focus closely on certain characters. And it's not, like, really plot-driven, but it's so immediate. I mean, that's what this is more about. It's just about immersion. You know, almost like a level like the beginning of Saving Private Ryan, except it's not actually first person. It's like, you're there! Yeah.
Well, for this is also a PG-13 movie, and for a war movie... This is a fairly bloodless war movie, but it does have that sort of old school war movie where guys clutch their chest and fall down and you know they've been killed. You're not going to see a lot of blood and viscera here, but you still feel every bullet hit.
Actually, I feel oddly enough, it's actually pretty character driven and by action because what they do really tells you a lot about all the characters. They don't necessarily like, say very wordless, but what they do is very much defining, especially the pair of the Irish and the Frenchman. Sorry, spoiler alert.
That's why you learn so much about these characters entirely by what they do and not by the conversations that they're having.
And also by what they don't do. And without entering spoilery territory regarding Cillian Murphy's character, what someone does not say about him is, I thought, one of the most moving parts of the movie. It was like, I got a little choked up. I got a lot choked up. Who are you looking at?
I think, to go back on what Chris said about that immersion, I think that's my favorite part of the movie, is the Germans. There is no character that is the Germans. You don't see a German person, I don't think, ever in the movie. And I think, like, putting us in the point of perspective of, like, the privates, because we're with the privates for, like, a third of the movie, and the Germans are just this hidden force that comes from below, comes from above, but you can just hear when it's too late. And that, like, kept me tense the entire time. And the sound design with the airplanes, it sounded like a like a deadly scream each time, and I was just like,
That way that he really has that with the sound design, amazing. That same experience that people are just waiting for the next thing, you know, because it just keeps happening, whether it's planes like dropping bombs or it's gunners from the Germans. They're just constantly, I mean, like everybody's just kind of quiet and waiting. And when it happens, you feel like you're as aware of it the second they are as well.
Yeah. Well, that was actually part of the whole design ethos, bizarre as it sounds, with the Luftwaffe, is that they actually wanted stuff that sounded scary. When they finessed Blitzkrieg in Spain, it really was, you want people to be terrified because there is a very distinctive sound that they're going to make. It's not like now where pretty much every jet sounds identical. You want people to know that there is a Heinkel coming your way.
Right.
People talk about
Nemi 109. You to be terrified.
Same reason TIE fighters make that weird howling sound.
Well,
you know,
that's
the Empire learned a lot from the Germans.
Well, you know, after years of World War II films, I mean, and I grew up, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and they were just constantly rerunning these movies that had been made in the 50s and 60s. You know, it was a constant stream of war films. And it seems like only in the past couple decades that filmmakers have started to kind of look at some of the German side, like, hey, these guys aren't all blank, anonymous villains. They're people, too, in a bad situation. This film, as John pointed out, is that, you know, they're largely anonymous. They are an external threat. We are aware that they are out there. And that drives the tension. And I think for a film that is so, so pro-British, that is so clearly wired into the British psyche, you really can't afford to cut away to Germans.
Yeah.
You know, you barely see the French, even though we know they're around too. The one time you think you're going to get a German, it isn't necessarily a German.
Right.
And you go, oh yes, of course, there are other people here. There are French people here.
There are
Danes. There are, you know, British. And it's a really smart choice. And I know that a lot of filmmakers today like to use that card of like, well, we're portraying the enemy as human beings too. But I think it's a smart decision not to do that.
It's definitely a very single-minded movie, and to do that would have served no purpose here.
Absolutely. Frankly. And even the famous Churchill speech regarding Dunkirk, the famous speech of the House of Commons, you know, we will fight on the beaches and so on. That, you do hear that in a way that I won't spoil. But yeah, again, I love that idea of like, we're not going to cut back to politicians. We're not going to cut back to generals.
The closest we get is Kenneth Branagh,
who's the admiral.
Who's an admiral who's like fucking there.
Yes. It's his job to organize the evacuation.
No, his job is to stand on the end of that pier the whole time, looking at everyone in the eye going, he's coming. Yeah. I'm good.
That was one weird thing that I didn't quite understand why they did it. The character is based on Senior Captain William Tennant, but he's called Bolton. Which is very bizarre. I'm not quite sure why they made that change. And if I ever got the chance to sit down with
Christopher Nolan,
I would say, like, why didn't you just make it Tennant? Quite literally, I think the only issue I have was, like, Tennant is such a pivotal figure that to not have it be Tennant is a little bit of an oddity.
It's the same reason you have Churchill.
Very much. Yeah. No. But the thing is, he was there.
I grant you that.
No, you have the... Branagh's character is Tennant. Tennant.
So why not have him
be called Tennant? That's not going to be a distraction.
I don't want to give you the big names. It's like,
but Tennant.
I agree. It's a dumb
choice. It's not a big. Tennant is the big name. Tennant is
American audiences
smaller.
Oh, it's my favorite Doctor.
Well,
so,
yeah, but even then, you know, he's such a in the kind of pantheon of British military heroes, he's kind of a smaller figure. He was pivotal on the day, but he's not. He's not up there with like a Haig or something. So it's an odd thing to not do. It would be just an oddity that like that's one of the few recognizable names. To not have him is going to be one of those things that I think for the deeper military stories are probably going to go. Why not just call him Tennant?
Is he a composite character?
I don't know, but he's clearly playing Tennant, and to not call him Tennant is just a bit of a weirdness.
Well, maybe regenerated. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Don't make me beam this can in your head.
Well, you know, there is that weird moment where there's, since we're talking about nitpicky things, and that's not a nitpick. I think what you just brought up, Richard, does bear mentioning. My nitpick was because we have these three alternating storylines. I realized at some point during the narrative that they weren't consecutive. At some point, we cut from a daylight scene to a nighttime scene, and then back to the daylight scene where we had previously left
this
off.
This is exactly what I was about to bring up.
Okay.
Because there's definitely some nonlinear storytelling going on here, and it happens a good deal. And I was like, it's interesting, but the rest of the film is so immersive. Every time I had to pull myself out of it for a second to go, wait a minute, where am I?
Yeah.
What is this the thing that we saw?
I think completely the opposite I think they were, those moments are where there is such an emotional convergence. Right. That's why they work.
Exactly. I really like that too because, it was pretty much clear that they're, even in the beginning, it's not the character. It all says 1 week, 1 hour, one day. So it's very clear that it's very clear that it's distinct points in time. So I really enjoyed that. When they all come together, it's very satisfying.
I like him. He can stay.
No. Until the next time when he disagrees with you.
It's very
here for our Valerian review. Yeah.
Well, I did like that too, that was my final justification. I just wanted to point it out to see if anybody else had any thoughts about it. Because dramatically it made sense.
There were some jarring moments, especially like when, again, not entering spoiler territory, when a certain thing happened with the pilot, and then you see him in the scene 5 minutes earlier. I'm like, well, that's... But I knew it was going on, so it didn't take me out of it, but it was definitely, I was aware of it.
Like I said, it's not to the point where it takes you out of it, where you're like, I don't like this.
It was just being aware of it.
I'm so immersed in what's happening in such an immediate way, and in those moments, I'm pulled back a little bit and have to go, oh, wait a minute, reconfigure.
I'm sure in the original script, this was all written much more linearly, and then in the edit, they just find the moments that work.
He dropped
best.
The pages, he's like, oh, shit.
And Nolan loves a non-linear storytelling.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, it was very similar. It was very. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree with Chris. It did take me out of it, and like maybe I'm a dumb reviewer, but at the beginning when it says 1 week, 1 day, and 1 hour, I didn't quite understand that it was like that. It was going to jump around. I thought it was just telling me like a distance sort of thing that it's going to take think about it in length of time, how fast they could get off, because I didn't know where the movie was going to go. And I brought my girlfriend with me, and so she doesn't think like all of you guys do in terms of, okay, this is how it's going to be told. Mm-hmm. And so she was telling me, yeah, I did get confused, especially in the first half. It isn't until the first time you see it line up and it makes a connection that it's like, okay, that's what we're doing here.
It's really not until the thing with the pilot where you really start to put together.
Yeah. Well, actually, Murphy's character when he's on the boat.
That's the one I meant, which is about like 30 minutes in.
About probably. That. And you're like, oh.
But, I mean, like I said, it's not a major, not really even a complaint. It's just like, I feel like I would have been that much more, I would have like lost track of time completely
and
if
I think
they hadn't had that aspect.
I think it's a choice that pays off in the end.
In the end, it does. This is definitely a fascinating film. And it's really, like, although there's so many hallmarks from Nolan here, nonetheless, this is a singular film for him that I think is going to win back a lot of people who perhaps maybe just got sick of where Nolan's been going lately with so much genre stuff. It's a very different war film from any we've seen before as well. And, I mean, I'm trying to see, what was the budget on this thing?
I mean, it was not inexpensive.
But at 106 minutes, this is a lean, tight, mean fighting machine and, of a movie, and it goes by fast.
Yeah, it does.
Well, see, it was very intense, and it didn't go by fast, but not in a bad way.
No.
It was very drawn in. But the one character, there's a character in this movie we haven't talked about, I was just so blown away by was the music. I don't usually like Hans Zimmer because it's always very, you know, bland and very.
Yeah.
But this is very percussive and intense, and it really just sucked me into the movie. And I was like, oh.
See, and I had some moments where, like, Hans Zimmer's really leaning into this little ticking clock motif. I get it. Time's ticking. And it's like, yes, Hans, we understand. And, you know, it did get a little bit. There were a few moments where I was like, I would find this scene much more interesting if they just drop me on a beach and it's silence and I'm just listening to hear. But no, Hans Zimmer's reminding me that the clock is ticking. And, you know, it's good. You know, it doesn't pull me out of the movie that much. But it is a bit inartful at times. But again, if we're nitpicking about that, I think that's a sure sign that this is a really good movie.
It really is.
Because we're nitpicking.
What are your final
now.
Thoughts there, Marco?
Okay. You know, like I said earlier, I think this is a return to form to a filmmaker that I've kind of lost a little bit of faith in over the years. I think he's finally back on track with a story that kind of hems him in and forces him to just focus on telling a story in as lean and visually efficient a manner as possible. I think you have great performances all across the board. Nobody really stands out, and I think that's by design. It's a very strong ensemble piece. And, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's, as Richard said, it's an important piece of history. It's not very well known to a lot of people, and I think for folks who are looking for, you know, when your dad always bitches about, like, oh, they don't make movies like they used to, take him to this movie, because this is something they'll like. It'll play for everybody. I give this 5 flaming spit stars. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. We go in the 10-point system.
Yes, we do.
You can go in the system you want. You take 5 out of 5. Whatever.
5 out of 5 flaming spit stars.
You can say 72 out of 72.
What the hell is a spit star?
Spit fire. I got mangled up in my head.
Scott.
I also thought this is a really wonderful movie. I was not, like you guys, I was kind of losing faith in Chris Nolan because he's made some pretty not stellar films. And I wasn't excited about this at all because, one, I knew nothing about the event. I was completely ignorant of what happened. And I don't love war movies typically because it's just not really my thing. So I was like, I don't know, war movie. But it was, I hate to use the word transcendent, but there were moments where it just completely blew me away. I just tried not to cry. I'm like, I'm fine. But I was just very much taken back by a lot of what happened. It was just really well done. The acting was amazing. It was lean storytelling. It was action-driven, not necessarily action-fighting, just really well done. And just everything worked. Everything just clicked. And it was a definite return to form. It was like taking everything that's great about Inception and The Prestige and fine-tuning it and making it just really work and really efficient. So I think it was just a really great film, and I was really glad to see something that was that much, you know, cinema. And I really was glad to see that, and I'm looking forward to seeing it in 70mm. So.
But how does it tie into The Black Lodge?
Well, there's actually a very direct correlation to The Black Lodge. Harry Styles is going to be on Twin Peaks, I think. So,
okay, fair enough. What's your arbitrary rating?
My arbitrary rating is 5 Terrence Malicks.
Fair enough. Jonathan Romo.
I'm one who does not like war movies at all. I just am tired of them. But the fact that Nolan actually had me interested the entire time, that he tells a different type of war movie that is not. It doesn't ever really make you feel great, or at least it never made me feel great. I was more anxious the entire time, and the idea of survival being the only focus. Like, we're not going to win something today. Yeah. You just have to get to tomorrow. And I love that idea. Also, I just have to say, Harry Styles shows up. He's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he's pretty solid. No one else really spoke on it too much. But, yeah, I'm a big fan of that. And everyone else, I think, in this movie, like, lines up really well in their part. And just they all balance each other out. Again, the only nitpick I have is the first, like, hour took me a second, or first 30 minutes took me a second to get used to with the whole lining up the different timelines. But all in all, I really enjoyed this. I like it more than Interstellar, and I'm excited to see Nolan continue to do different things like this. So I have to give it 9 out of 10 One Direction spin-off projects.
Nice. Richard Whittaker!
No, you go first, Claudio.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, maybe you should take us out with our extended lesson on English history.
Yeah, you should. Yeah.
No, this is a great movie. I wouldn't even know what to say to somebody who didn't like this movie. It's so, from the first frames of this thing, it's so incredibly immersive. It just grabs you and throws you right in the middle of an incredibly tense situation. Great performances all around. Although, yes, Tom Hardy does spend most of the movie with a mask on. He's not trying to talk through it for most of it, which is nice. He's just kicking ass in the air.
Being, he doesn't like, do his Bane voice.
I want to play the Tom Hardy Spitfire pilot game of this. Like, yeah, I'm flying one of those pieces of shit and take down some Nazis. Fuck it. Yeah, this is going to be looked at as one of Nolan's best, for sure. And I give it 9 out of 10 sinking ships. And now, Richard Whittaker.
There is a very...
Well, that was nice. Anyway, that was it for the review. Sorry, go ahead. You know I had to, Richard.
Yeah, you didn't.
There he edited out the fist fight, by the way.
He's not going to edit out the next one.
Subscribers will get to see the whole blow-by-blow play.
I've already punched him in the kidneys once this evening.
That's true, you did.
There is a very short list of truly great war movies. Really, there's 633 Squadron, Dam Busters, Steel Helmet, Big Red One, Bridge Too Far, The Longest Day.
Bridge on the River Kwai.
Bridge on the River Kwai is great, but it is a POW movie, which is a different genre.
Oh, so you don't count stuff like The Dirty Dozen.
Those are fun action heroes. They're not great war movies. Saving Private Ryan and Das Boot. Goes on the list. This goes straight on the list. It is extraordinary that you see something that you go, you know what, this just deserves a place in the canon right away. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. This is just an extraordinary piece of ensemble filmmaking, which I think the best war movies usually are. This is a remarkable cast that's put together. This film, apart from the fact that, you know, it's Nolan is using all the contemporary tools, this film could have been made at any point in the last 70 years.
Yeah.
That is an extraordinary testament to just how powerful and moving and transcendent this is as a piece of cinema. And it is profoundly British. I think, Nolan is one of the few directors who has the clout to go, you know, I need $100 million to make a movie about, you know, his battle in Europe before America even got involved in the war, and to do it honestly and earnestly and say something about the British character, and to get away with it with pretty much no studio interference. This is an extraordinary film, and I give it 10 healing cups of tea. With a nice thick doorstep of bread smothered with homemade jam, out of 10.
I'm so hungry right now.
It solves everything. A cup of tea and a nice piece of bread with some jam solves everything.
This movie is so British it shits the Queen. Seriously, it's just like, it's so British I expected Monty Python to show up at some point. And so, come on, people, help me here. It's so British that...
Why? I'm just enjoying watching you dig your own hole.
I just do it to torture Richard, that's all. Every time I say one, his face squeezes.
He's already punched you in the kidneys. I don't want to get punched.
Well, John Romo's sitting between the two of us, so I feel like...
Peter Molyneux. There's a British guy. I got one.
And one last thing, the kid who played George, the kid on the boat.
Oh, yeah.
The most British-looking kid who ever lived.
Yeah, he does have a face like a bag of spanners.
Like,
yeah.
they pluck him out of, like, you know, some Charles Dickens level of the wall or something. He just looks so utterly British.
Facially, he's the equivalent of Benedict Cumberbatch's name.